pushing in. And if a saint step out of line, you have to start again. Cause Jacob's golden ladder gets slippery at the top. And many a happy-go-lucky saint has made that long, long drop. If I'm late, don't wait. Go on without me. I may tarry a while. Cause I mean to know before I go how come the devil smiles.
Step by step. By Jesse Winchester. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. More than 1,000 Harvard students walked out of their commencement yesterday to support 13 undergraduates who were barred from graduating after they participated in the Gaza Solidarity Encampment in Harvard Yard. The students left in a long, slow procession as many chanted, "Let them walk," while others carried Palestinian flags.
Let them walk! Let them walk! Let them walk! Let them walk! Let them walk!
The students walked out of the graduation and went to a nearby church to host a people's commencement ceremony to honor the 13 undergrads denied their Harvard diplomas. Meanwhile, this is Harvard University senior Shruti Kumar, who went off script as she gave the English commencement address, slamming Harvard for denying the degrees. She read from notes that she pulled out of her graduation gown.
In the fall, my name and identity, alongside other black and brown students at Harvard, was publicly targeted. For many of us students of color, doxing left our jobs uncertain, our safety uncertain. This semester, our freedom of speech and our expressions of solidarity became punishable. Leaving our graduations uncertain. As I stand before you today, I must take a moment to recognize my peers. The 13 undergraduates undergraduates in the class of 2024 who will not graduate today. I am deeply disappointed by the intolerance for freedom of speech and the right to civil disobedience on campus. Over 1,500 students had petitioned. Nearly 500 staff and faculty had spoken up, all overwhelmingly against the unprecedented sanctions. As an American and as a Harvard graduate, for me, what is happening on campus is about liberty. This is about civil rights and upholding democratic principles. The students had spoken. The faculty had spoken. Hear us? Yeah.
is Harvard University student Shruti Kumar. For more, we're joined by Alison Frank Johnson, professor of history at Harvard University. On Monday, she joined 115 faculty members to vote to confer degrees on the 13 seniors. We're also joined by Asmer Safi, senior at Harvard College, majoring in social studies and ethnicity, migration and rights, one of the 13 pro-Palestinian student protesters barred from graduating. He's a Rhodes Scholar. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Asmer Safi, let's start with you. I'd like to say congratulations on graduating. But you didn't get to participate in that graduation in a formal way, though many might say what you did was so significant that that is what's going to go down in history of this period. Can you talk about what happened and why you weren't part of the graduation in the Harvard Yard?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Amy. As part of my involvement with the Gaza Solidarity Campaign and the encampment itself, and generally my activism with the Palestine Solidarity Committee and the Harvard Out of Occupied Palestine Coalition on Harvard's campus, we've seen multiple waves of repression over the last few years. And this is, again, a problem that is not new, particularly with regards to my involvement in the encampment itself. The university decided to put me on probation for until May 17th of 2025, which essentially means that I'm a student and not in good standing and will not be allowed to get my degree, which essentially means that anything that I had planned for my postgraduate plans is something that now hangs in the balance and something that I can have no certainty over. But
do you get to keep your Rhodes Scholarship?
So as of now, my Rhodes Scholarship remains intact because the people at Rhodes House have been incredibly supportive and believe that I am, in fact, fighting the world's fight. However, as a consequence of not getting my degree on time, there are chances that I might not be able to matriculate at Oxford on time next year.
Let me ask the professor. You are one of more than 100 professors who have signed on to a demand that these 13 students graduate, Professor Alison Frank Johnson. Can you talk about what's happened to him and the bigger issue, why you're a part of this movement?
Well, I want to acknowledge, first of all, that it's the students who are really leading the movement, and the faculty are supporting students. So I'm here in support of the students rather than as a representative of a movement, per se. What I wanted to do was to see the university recognize that these students have fulfilled all of the requirements for the degree, that they engaged in a peaceful protest, that the punishments that were meted out to them were not in keeping with years, decades of precedent at Harvard University, where peaceful protest is understood to be a part of the learning process, one of the ways that students act out what we are teaching them about civil disobedience, about how to enact change, about how to move society forward, about how to encourage people to think about things that they would rather shut out of their minds. And having taken those lessons that they learn in our classrooms and applied them through taking up their right to peacefully protest in the yard, which is, in fact, enshrined in the university statement on rights and responsibilities, that right to protest, that they were being punished in ways that we thought were inappropriate for Harvard College. And having pursued multiple avenues to try to encourage authorities within the university to understand that from the students' perspective and from our perspective, this was an egregious departure from past precedent, we found ourselves in the unusual situation of being told that 13 students weren't going to graduate anyway. And so we looked very carefully at our rights within the university statutes and determined that as a faculty, we actually have the right to present a motion to, an amendment to the motion through which we decide which degrees to confer, adding those students' names back in. And that amendment received overwhelming support at the degree conferral meeting of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. And so we hoped then that the corporation, as it has always done in the past, would accept our recommendations for degree recipients and allow the 13 to graduate, which they chose not to do.
Asmar Safi, you did participate, though not officially sanctioned, in the yard, the major graduation, then walked out to the People's Commencement with so many other hundreds of students. Would you do this again, by the way? Would you, the events that led to your being prevented at this point from getting a diploma?
Absolutely. I think, if anything, all the protesters at the Gaza Solidarity Encampment were aware of the fact that consequences and retribution on some kind of level would be imminent regardless of, you know, what level of involvement individuals partook in when it came to the encampment itself. And I think what's important to realize here is that no one did not see some level of consequences coming our way. Just the unprecedented level and the severity of with which they've been enacted were sort of surprising for us. But at the same time, I think, again, this is an ethical stance that we're taking. It's not something that is, you know, marred by circumstance, or if one time something doesn't work out, students will, you know, suddenly back down, or if, you know, one time consequences are lashed out in a very severe fashion, students will refuse to engage in protest actions. I think one thing that we have consistently seen on Harvard's campus and beyond is the fact that regardless of the severity of punishment, whether that's at Columbia, at Northeastern, at Emerson, at Northwestern recently, or at Harvard's campus itself, these things keep propping back up, and it's because of a firm ethical resolve that students have been able to, determine for themselves, and have, you know, led by example through for the rest of the country to be able to witness, and that these consequences are only exposing the rot that is, you know, imminent to all of these different institutions and the ways in which they are sort of beholden to corporations, to donor pressure, to outside pressure, as opposed to listening to the very sort of rightful demands of their own students and faculty and members of staff that they have been championing for ages at this point. And again, the call for divestment is not new. Yes, it might have gotten, you know, newfound popularity in the last few months given the events and the genocide in Gaza, but at the same time, divestment has been called for years on Harvard's campus alone and has always been met with repercussions. The fact that the movement keeps propping back up is sort of emblematic of the resolve of students. And I think I, if I were in that position again, would gladly take that same step.
And Professor Johnson, in the Harvard Crimson, government professor Stephen Levitsky is quoted as saying there is a potential for a faculty rebellion against the Harvard Corporation's decision to not allow these 13 students to graduate. Do you view this as a possibility?
Well, I think the level of frustration is so high that faculty are ready to do what they can. I have to be honest that I'm not sure what the statutes allow us to do as far as rebelling against the corporation. I think this is one of the problems we see in many democracies, is there are all sorts of rules that suggest that people have power, but then include exceptions which allow some authoritarian body to actually overrule their voice. And the corporation's refusal to accept our recommendation for degree conferral is an example of them acting within rights that they have. So it's not clear to me how we can practically rebel against this body that seems to be able at will to disregard our pleas and our decisions, but certainly the lack of confidence is couldn't be greater, I believe, in the corporation. And to the extent that faculty can express their displeasure with the corporation, I think we are very much willing to do that.
And finally, I want to give the last word to Asmar Safi. You have the previous Harvard president, Claudine Gay, ultimately pushed out. Ultimately, it was over this issue when she was questioned in Congress. I'm wondering your message, not only to the Harvard administration and what they call the corporation, but to the Biden administration.
I mean, it's very, very simple. As an individual that is, you know, a taxpayer in this country, as someone that studies here, lives here, it is absolutely abhorrent that we are abetting and aiding genocide in every sense of the way, enabling it, not recognizing calls that are being made under the purview of our free speech and First Amendment rights. And I think the Biden administration with all its sort of me as a student, I am aspiring for an ideal in a world that I can live in, where the government is somehow sort of like liable to the things that we have to say here. And I think, despite its constant failure, the Biden government needs to necessarily hear the fact that students across the country are calling for one particular thing and showing up in the same way and showing up over and over again. And if university administrators and institutions and corporations cannot be able to listen to that kind of message, it should be at least clear, even if they choose to ignore it, choose to falsify it, choose to meet it with repression, the claim that students stand with Palestine, students stand with Gaza, students stand against genocide, against warfare, against arming countries, and against materially aiding any sort of conflict that has a loss of human life central to how it sort of goes on. And I think for me as a student, for someone that has had my faith in both the university administration but also the U.S. government at large be completely shaken as a consequence of the actions that I've seen at Harvard and beyond, with my peers being met with police repression on campuses across the country, I genuinely lack faith in the ways in which these systems work. And for me as a student right now and my peers, the goal is to reimagine the world that we live in and sort of be able to construct it from down below, just so we can be able to aspire to the future of the world that we want to live in.
Asmer Safi, I want to thank you for being with us. Senior at Harvard College, one of 13 pro-Palestinian student protesters barred from graduating yesterday. And Allison Frank Johnson, professor of history at Harvard University. When we come back, we'll be joined by one of Egypt's leading human rights advocates, Hossem Bakkat. He is in the U.S. after Egypt finally lifted an 8-year travel ban on him. Back in 20 seconds. يا فلسطيني يا والبندقاني رهان الصهيوني يا ضد الحمام تحتيناك يا فلسطيني يا والبندقاني رهان الصهيوني يا ضد الحمام تحتيناك يا فلسطيني يا ولا بدي اسافر حيداك ضهري بيديا وايديا تنزل معاك Ya Palestinia, O Palestinians, by Sheikh Imam. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about student uprisings here in the United States on university campuses in solidarity with Palestine and against Israel's war on Gaza, in Egypt, which borders Gaza, students are being imprisoned for being in solidarity with Palestine. Earlier this month, two students were jailed on terrorism charges after they were forcibly disappeared following expressions of solidarity with Palestinians. The two students are just the latest in a wave of arrests targeting protesters and activists in Egypt organizing to show support for Palestine. We're now joined by Hossem Bakkat, one of Egypt's leading human rights advocates. The executive director of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights also worked as an investigative journalist for the independent media outlet Matamasser. He was banned from traveling outside Egypt for the past 8 years. His assets were also frozen as part of an Egyptian government crackdown on human rights NGOs. In March, Egyptian authorities finally closed the case against his group and other human rights groups and lifted the travel ban. Hossem Bakkat joins us now in our New York studio. It's great to see you here in the United States. I last saw you in Sharm el-Sheikh at the UN Climate Summit. You could go there because Sharm el-Sheikh is in Egypt, but you couldn't travel outside. Can you talk about the latest news? Now Israel's taken over the Rafah border with Egypt, but the students, Egyptian students who are protesting, being disappeared by the Egyptian government.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be back here, and it's good to see you again. We see, of course, the arrest of these two students in a broader context of a crackdown that started really as early as October, the first month of the war, on pro-Palestinian voices. My organization has documented since then over 120 arrests in a number of different governorates throughout the country. All of them were presented to state security prosecution, were charged under the terrorism law of belonging to illegal organizations and spreading false information. The vast majority of them for having participated in spontaneous or pre-planned protests, or really stands to chant for Palestine against the war. But some of them were arrested even for perfectly legal acts, even by the standards of Egypt's very repressive laws, like hanging banners, for instance, or writing social media posts, because the broader context, even beyond this war, of course, is one where, you know, for the last 10 years, as you know, one of President Sisi's first acts upon coming to power was to pass a very repressive anti-protest law that brought the number of demonstrations in Egypt down to zero. And of course, there is a fear within the system that allowing people to voice support and solidarity with Palestinians' opposition to Israel will extend not just to criticism of the Egyptians' official position vis-a-vis the war that many Egyptians feel has been inadequate, to put it very mildly, but also extend to the domestic situation, the human rights situation, the unprecedented economic crisis the country is going through. And that volatility, that fragility, of course, is what has led to these arrests. And of the 120, we know of at least 93 individuals that are currently sitting in prison in pretrial detention, of course, in perpetuity, for joining pro-Palestinian protests in Egypt.
Can you talk more about Egypt's role in the siege of Gaza since October 7th?
Since October 7th, Egypt has done one thing right, which is, of course, to speak out and stand against the ideas, the plans, the very real possibilities of the forced displacement of the people of Gaza into Sinai, into Egypt. And we and many others supported this Egyptian position. However, at the same time, we felt that, you know, you can do that and at the same time, you know, fulfill Egypt's legal obligations under international law, but also as a neighboring country, but also as Egypt. You know, this is Palestine, right? But more importantly, in the interest of Egypt's national security concerns, that Egypt should have done so much more. So what we saw from the very beginning is that in order for the Egyptian government to preserve this red line of, you know, no displacement of Gazans into Sinai and prevent the reoccupation of Gaza, Egypt has basically accepted every term that Israel imposed on it, and to a degree, really, of actual collusion. I don't want to say complicity. And that included, of course, giving Israelis complete control on the vetting of who comes out of Gaza, even the humanitarian cases, even the foreign citizens, the binationals, the international organization staff, even Egyptians stranded in Gaza trying to come home, run away from the war. The Egyptians still sent their names to COGAT, the Israeli military occupation forces, for prior vetting. Egypt has denied access into Gaza to the international media, to Egyptian media, to human rights investigators. They have not been allowed by the Egyptian side. And when I say this, of course, I know that Egypt is only in charge of the Egyptian side of the border. But, you know, why do Israel's bidding by denying them, at the Egyptian side? I mean, let them go in and let Israel deal with them, or turn them back, or block access, or maybe they would be allowed. Our participation in the mechanism of the so-called inspection of humanitarian aid, accepting the entire Israeli operation that has really led to this man-made famine situation we are in right now, all of this, I mean, if you add to it, of course, the very, you know, muted, reserved, you know, statements and tone of the Egyptian government, and then confining Egypt to a role of a mediator between the parties. Everyone, and we launched a petition, you know, again, as early as October 19th, Egyptian activists, political opponents, journalists, human rights defenders, lawyers, you know, political parties, all calling on Egypt, not just on human rights, humanitarian, basic humanity tenets, but also in Egypt's national interest to, you know, really scale up its response, lead a global coalition to isolate Israel if it refuses to abide by international law and accept a ceasefire, you know, recall the Egyptian ambassador to Israel, which hasn't happened yet, you know, end not the peace treaty, but at least, you know, the unprecedented levels of not just the security and defense cooperation, but trade and investment, the natural gas imports that we get from Gaza. There are so many things that the Egyptian regime could and should have done as early on. I mean, right now, of course, because after 7 months and after Egypt, official Egypt, has done everything to please Israel and the United States in the naive hope that this would make them too embarrassed to, you know, the Israelis to come into Rafah and to threaten the displacement. Now, the one thing that Egypt asked for in return is not guaranteed, which is why we see now finally Egypt taking moves like refusing to cooperate with Israel on access of humanitarian aid and the coordination, and deciding or announcing its intention to join South Africa's genocide case at the ICJ when it comes to the merits phase.
So let's talk about that before we end. As a leading human rights advocate, what do these cases at the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court mean to you, with Egypt saying they're joining South Africa in its genocide case against Israel?
Egypt's decision is welcome, but these cases are about much more than this. These cases are about really, you know, our movement refusing to just take this hit to the project of human rights, the ideal of human rights that is caused by the complicity of governments like the United States and Germany, and the utter and public disregard for international law and accountability. We need to make sure that we reclaim these institutions, that we don't just give up on this and say, you know, international law, international justice, accountability don't exist. And, you know, all of us are involved in this effort. It's not just, you know, South Africa and the ICJ. It is the students here in this country that were just on this show and what they're doing. Our organization joined the Center for Constitutional Rights here in the United States in a lawsuit charging Biden, Blinken, and Austin with aiding and abetting genocide before a federal court on behalf of Palestinian organizations and Palestinian American citizens. What Jewish Voices for Peace are doing, what the Palestinian, of course, organizations and groups like Law for Palestine are doing, we cannot really take this lying down and say, okay, human rights was a lie, you know, hypocrisy wins, you know, there is no room for international law and international justice. We rise, we fight, and we reclaim these institutions and reclaim these ideals and occupy these spaces.
So you have Egypt saying they're joining the genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, and yet they are participating in blocking the aid that's leading to what is called a full-blown famine.
I want to be clear that Egypt is not blocking the aid, but by accepting the Israeli conditions for at least the first 7 months on the access of aid, on the so-called inspection of the aid, when people, including, you know, U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen, went to Rafah with Senator Merkley and saw what happened and came back and said, these are not inspections and Egypt is not inclusion. But what I'm saying is, right now, since Netanyahu broke his promise and, you know, went into Rafah and is now threatening to really reoccupy the border area, Egypt has finally decided to stop collaboration, really, with these Israeli measures and restrictions that have led to the famine. We are saying that this is too late, too little, and not nearly enough, but more importantly, it should have happened 7 months ago.
Hossam Paket, I want to let people know that just as we're ending this broadcast, the International Court of Justice is going to announce their decision on an emergency case around South Africa's case against genocide against Israel. We will post online find your response at democracynow.org. Hossein Baghet is Egyptian human rights activist, founder and executive director of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, EIPR, in Cairo, just out of Egypt after an 8-year travel ban on him. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The Students of Caribbean and African Ancestry presents Catcha Vibes. Join Soca for a night of music, food, games, and pure vibes. The location is the Student Union Building, room 1430. The date is May 24th, 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. We hope to see you there.
Nobody could do as a part on too much. And it's about Bajun Shalom, Kabukabulo, Mobajin.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast.